From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman. On this episode, the Demolition Derby. Americans have been intentionally ramming cars into each other for sport since the 1950s. If you go to the county fair, you know all about it.
Demolition Derby is this kind of ancient metal blood sport. You know, where you take these machines and you kill the machines kill each other.
It sounds like the Roman Colosseum, only cars. Like, this is the Midwest's Colosseum.
Right. Yeah. It is like a gladiator thing, you know, where you've got all these people, you know, in there, they've got their cars, they've been getting them ready, and they know each other's weaknesses, they know the other car's weaknesses, and they go out and they destroy the other car, and you know, the last car running wins.
That's Frank Morris. We work together at Kansas City's public radio station. A while back, he rode in the passenger seat of a Demolition Derby car, and he recorded the whole thing.
You're just kind of riding, and then, unlike an amusement ride, you know, this thing is kind of cobbled together, and there was a lot of sharp stuff, and, you know, everything was rusty in there. I was sitting on the gas. I was sitting, you know, my legs were over the gas tank, like a sharp, square gas tank. And after the car got killed and, you know, there was a break and everybody, you know, like all the dead cars, you know, get evacuated. And I just kind of go like hobbling over to the stands. I'm sitting there in the stands taking it all in. And this nice little kid says, "Mister, your leg's bleeding." And, you know, I have blood all the way, you know, down my leg into my sock because of these two, pretty deep cuts. I didn't even notice that I got. I still have a scar from it.
So you were, like, legit scared.
Oh, man. Yeah.
People flock to the fairgrounds every year for the Derby to see people destroying cars for fun. Because even as a spectator, you can't help but feel the thrill and danger of the whole thing. The speed, the adrenaline. And people have loved that for generations. But now it looks like the whole thing might be running out of gas. We will get to that, but I want you to know a little bit more about Frank and why he cares.
We're ringed on the track, we're riding line. The green flag down and I'm stopping mine. It's the Demo Derby. The Demo Derby.
So Frank and I have known each other for more than 10 years now.
Isn't that something?
It is crazy.
Yeah.
It does not feel like that long.
Nope.
He's got a mustache, a leather jacket, and this unmistakable glint of mischief in his eyes. He grew up in Nickerson, Kansas, population 1,000-ish, and he's always been kind of wild.
When I was a kid, I was always getting in fights. And then when I got to be a teenager, I was kind of, became, I think, known as a wild and reckless guy within a wild and reckless group of people.
Did you think of yourself that way?
Yeah, kind of. Like after I got to college, you know, when I got to college, I realized that all my friends who were like punk rockers were so wimpy, you know, compared to like my old redneck buddies. Like the like sort of level of danger that they thought was really, horrifying or whatever was kind of paltry compared to these guys that I grew up with, who were just bored out of their minds and just willing to do anything.
Redneck is a controversial term, but it's one Frank embraces as a point of pride because he looks back on his own past, like the 1970s, really fondly.
You know, I had friends who could, like, pull a wheelie in third gear on their Kawasaki doing 80 miles an hour, stuff like that, just, you know, drag racing and, you know, zipping around country roads really fast on acid, you know, doing all kinds of like crazy drugs and you know, combining that with cars, not fast cars, but like sort of aggressively driving crummy old cars. That's what my little town was like when I left it.
But things are changing in rural America, in our economy, even in cars themselves. And all of that comes together in the weirdly fascinating history of this sport.
It's closely related to jalopy racing. These old cars, you just race them around a track, and, you know, there are crashes and stuff. It didn't matter because they're just old cars that are souped up.
Kasdan in the only pickup truck out there. He's not hard to miss in the Union 76.
And, you know, demo derby then kind of exploded in the 70s, I think. It just got really, really big. I think you started seeing televised demo derbies in the late 60s. You know, Wide World of Sports. Look at this crazy phenomenon, the demolition derby. But in the 80s is when it really kind of reached its apex with tons and tons and tons of people participating. And, you know, and then since then it's gotten more and more rarefied, at least at the top.
Frank is an adult now, at least in theory. He's a national correspondent from the Midwest. He reports on trucker shortages, tornadoes, that kind of thing. A few years ago, he went to the demolition derby at the Franklin County Fair in Kansas.
Hey, welcome everybody to the, I think this is a demolition derby, isn't it? Correct me if I'm wrong.
The idea originally was that I was going to follow somebody, you know, finding a car, fixing up the car, and then running the car in a demo derby. And I just think it's cool. You know, I'm not mechanically inclined at all, but, you know, my dad was. I really respect that kind of stuff.
Frank finds John Green. John loves the derby.
Nothing better. I mean, a lot of people say they would do it, but until you get in there and do it, you never know the real feeling.
On this particular day, it's 90-plus degrees.
You know, it's butt hot out in Kansas, and so I'm wearing shorts, you know, just a kind of a raggedy pair of cut-off shorts. And believe me, nobody in demo derby wears shorts because they're mainly country people. Country people tend not to ever wear shorts. And so that was one of the things that was kind of like sort of astounding to this guy that I got to ride with. You know, I'm like, yeah, so this is great. I'll just get in. He's like, well, you're not wearing shorts, are you? And I'm like, well, yeah, you know, it'll be fine. It's like, well, I don't think so. I don't know. It's not a good idea. I'm like, oh, come on. It'll be cool. It's like, well, okay. So that's on you, you know.
So you know how that worked out for him. But John Green also told Frank something else he wasn't expecting to hear, that the old-fashioned demolition derby is in trouble.
Another year, then it's over.
You think?
At least for around here, there's not enough people to keep it going.
Wow.
Why is that happening? Why can't it keep going?
So it's become expensive, really, really time-consuming, and you're having just fewer and fewer drivers. The number of drivers has just dropped off precipitously. And then also, you just don't have the same kind of ethic in place as strongly as before, where, you know, just going out and hacking around with a car for a few months to, you know, run it in the demo derby was just a load of fun. And now it's something, you know, the prize money's a lot higher.
So it's not that no one's derbing anymore. It's that you've got rich people pouring serious money into their cars. And that makes it harder for regular folks to even compete. In some extreme cases, people are paying up to $50,000 for a car that someone else built. All they have to do is turn the key and they have an awesome derby car without ever setting foot in a garage. And the other thing is, cars have been changing. They have a lot more plastic than they used to, which is not ideal.
So, you know, you can't go out and successfully take a 96 Camry up against a 72 Eldorado. It's just going to annihilate you. And so these big 70s cars, obviously there's only so many of them. And so there's been kind of an arms race.
As it gets harder and harder to find those cool 70s cars that just dominate, people have resorted to winning by coming up with new ways to get around the rules. So the sport keeps changing. It can be hard to keep up, and it just takes a lot of mechanical knowledge and resourcefulness to build a car that can compete. In fact, they say the real competition happens in the garage. So Frank went to a garage in Wellsville, Kansas, to meet the next generation of competitors.
So yeah, Brent Palmer is wrenching away. This is his car, and he is going, you know, pedal to the metal, getting this thing ready.
This car doesn't have a drive shaft, brakes, motor, tranny, radiator. Needs bumper shocks, leaf spring clamps. It'll run Saturday.
And so he's under there in crazy angles working. He's got a couple of other buddies. Everybody's drinking. There's you know, everybody's drinking beer. There's one guy that's got a bottle of whiskey that, he, you know, he's just kind of like nursing this bottle of whiskey. There's a, you know, sparks flying all in, you know, from the welder, from the, you know, grinder. It's pretty invigorating.
This guy has got a garage, tools, and a lot of friends helping out. Exactly what you need to win these days.
Back in the corner, there's a young woman working this grinder, grinding away, you know, very methodically, very purposefully working on parts. And it turns out that she is like demo derby royalty.
I mean, this is what we do. This is our lives. It's having fun with family and friends.
Shelby Miller is royalty because she comes from this whole family of derby drivers. She has an office job, but she still works on derby cars every weekend, all weekend long. And she's a driver, too. In fact, she won a pretty big derby just this past year.
So what motivates you? What keeps you doing this?
I would say the adrenaline rush. I mean, it's like nothing you've ever done before. It's very addicting. It kind of is my like anger management almost, because I get to go out there and basically go nuts if you want to. I mean, you can do whatever. Well, you can't obviously hit him in the driver's door. There's certain levels that you cannot cross.
I tell you, you know, I still have a scar on my leg
really?
From the short couple of minutes I was out. It wasn't really set up for a passenger that well,
uh-huh.
And I was wearing shorts.
Oh, no.
But, you know, it was terrifying for
yeah.
me. I mean, you know, I didn't think I'd be that scared. I thought, you know, oh, yeah, boom, boom, whatever,
yeah.
You know, I'm not, I don't consider myself, like, easily scared.
Uh-huh. I don't know why I never was scared. I get nervous when I first pull out there, like I'm going to big day, you know, game show. But after the first hit goes away, it kind of just goes away, so... But I've never really been scared. I don't know how or why, but I don't. Probably because I grew up around it, so I knew what was expected. I think the real derbyer is about to pull up.
So Doug Miller, Shelby's dad, is a stud demo derby driver from the 80s.
Yeah, he's taught me everything I know. So, and I still have a lot to learn.
So tell me, how did you choose your children's names?
Well, Shelby's off of a Shelby Mustang, and Derby is named after Derbyan. So I'm a gearhead, so it worked out that way.
And Shelby's mom was a very credible demolition derby driver in the women's class. So, it's a family thing. She has grown up in the shop.
It's not just a, you know, a lousy sport that we go out there and smash cars and get drunk and, you know what I mean? It's complete opposite, really. It's hard work. It teaches you a ton of things that you need to, I think, personally have as life skills, like being able to change your own oil in your car, change a tire, but it definitely teaches you hard work and dedication and motivation. And I mean, the hours are nuts that you put into one of these weld cars. You know, if your family's not involved in it, then you wouldn't get to see your family, like, at all.
Shelby and her brother, Derby, they're the future of this sport. Even their dad is changing with the times. The Millers make high-end parts for those expensive derby cars. But they are still nostalgic for the way it used to be.
It's kind of a deal now. Money is no object to some of these people. They'll spend, $3,000 to $4,000 on their cars, on stuff to go in them. And back when I started, it was just a deal where you bought a car for $50, you ran the motor that was in it, and you had fun doing it and drank a few beers. And it's nothing like that no more.
So Frank, when you think about Demolition Derby changing or dying, does it make you sad?
Well, yeah, you know, I like that kind of stuff, you know? I like that just kind of 70s hellion, you know, Evel Knievel and, you know, all that stuff. It makes me a little sad that it goes away. But, I mean, you know, things change.
It is sad. What's hard for me to understand, I guess, is just putting all that blood, sweat, and tears into building something just perfectly, you know, when the whole idea is that you're sending it off to be destroyed. Maybe I'm just too precious about things. But it also sounds kind of wasteful, just trashing cars.
These are cars that are heading for the scrapyard anyway, by and large. And so this is just a way of getting something out of them. But yeah, you know, I mean, for me, like the image of a farmer straightening out a nail, you know, a farmer, I mean, this is the way I grew up. The farmers I knew, you know, you pull a nail out of the fence to, you know, fix the fence. This guy would sit there and, you know, put it on top of the fence post, bend side up and tap it down, use it again. You know, that's just the way it was. You know, my buddy Luis Blastegui from Argentina, he's the same damn way. You know, he drives him crazy that people just buy stuff and throw it away. Well, rural folks, at least used to be, and I think for the most part still are, you know, pretty against wasting anything. They don't like waste.
Something I didn't realize about the Demolition Derby is that there are different kinds of derbies and different classes of competitors. So even though that sophisticated, like really expensive style of derbying is kind of taking over, there are still people doing that scrappier thing. They call it hobo class.
The hobo class is supposed to be kind of the savior of demo derby. It's the, we're going to scale back, we're going to tightly control the kinds of things you can do to the car. We're going to prohibit a whole bunch of modifications that anybody who's demo derbying at higher levels would do automatically.
A little guy can do it. It don't cost $20,000 to build a car. You can go out and buy a car for $500 and you can derby. You can be competitive. That's where it should be.
I ran into this guy, Hugh Griggs, who is apparently has, you know, derbed for years, used to be in the more competitive weld class, but he just got sick of it. So he's back to a class where you can just basically prepare a crummy old car in the space of a couple of weekends.
You know, like the car I'm driving, it's made in the 90s. It's not half as tough as an older car made in the 70s, so I have to drive it, you know, and I can't hit real hard with it, but I have to be strategic in where I hit. A 92 Lincoln.
It's not super popular among spectators, I think.
Oh, that's sad. I mean, because it reminds me more of, like, some kind of grown-up version of just bumper cars, you know?
Well, yeah, yeah. And that's... It's more, but you know, it's a lower barrier to entry. But you know, even with hobo class and you know, the prize money's nothing. You have to pick your car, and you have to know about, you know, the strengths and vulnerabilities of other cars out there. It's not as easy as you might think it would be. It's just it takes a lot of the shop work out.
But like, it still takes a certain type of person to do this, right?
Well, you know, I mean, you would think so. However, I have come to believe that the most successful demo derby people are not necessarily the most aggressive or the most, least risk averse, but they're very methodical, you know, and they're smart about what they're doing. And they keep calm. They have good situational awareness. So, I mean, it may be not as nuts as it appears. You know? I mean, like, you might be good at it, Gina.
I don't think so, but I am sad that the sport is dying in a way, at least in its purest form, because part of what I love about the Midwest is that there's this whole culture here, or there has been, of wild abandon, you know? Not just that, people with skills I can't comprehend, and a fearlessness that I envy. I like knowing that there's someone down the street who can get me out of a bind or kill it in the Derby with a wrench and a blowtorch. Today on Central Standard, we are listening to some episodes of a podcast I host called Midwesternish. Coming up, the Midwestern accent.
Caramel or caramel? How do you pronounce it, Suzanne?
Caramel.
Caramel. You're with the majority, 64%.
But first, just a couple of things. We are only hearing a couple of our favorite episodes today, and it was a tough decision what to share. So you should listen to other ones. There's an episode about being Midwest famous, starring the McFadden brothers, and one about Minnesota trying to break up with us. Subscribe now wherever you get your podcasts. Perfect for binge listening on a spring road trip. While we're talking about road trips, we're hosting a storytelling event at the Record Bar, Monday, April 23rd. It's a night of Midwestern road trip stories. It starts at 6:30 and it's free. Just RSVP at kcur.org/live. One last thing. If you have an observation about the Midwest that you want us to investigate, email us, midwesternish@kcur.org. We are on Twitter, @midwesternish, or we have a phone number. Call 816-235-2797. Leave us a message in less than a minute. The number again is 816-235-2797. Your idea could find its way into our next season. Okay, I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay with us for more Midwesternish. From a dot in the middle of the map, this is Midwesternish. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is Suzanne Hogan. She's the producer of this podcast, and she didn't used to think she had an accent.
It never really occurred to me that I had an accent until, you know, just traveling around the U.S. and then even going abroad to other countries and people commenting on the way that I spoke English.
What did people say to you?
We did this exercise with some of our friends, our French friends. We were touring around in France, and their English wasn't that good, and our French wasn't that good either. So, you know, we're all kind of navigating communication through chopped up styles of communicating. But one time, we were just drinking, and we were like, all right, what do we sound like to you? And we had our friend Thomas kind of do this, like kind of like a banjo, and I was thinking, like, is that what it sounds like to you when I talk? And he said, well, what do I sound like to you? And like, oh, like, you know.
So Suzanne and I were recently talking about our accents. We're both from Kansas City, and we both grew up believing in that myth that Midwesterners don't have accents, which is just false. We know we don't talk like New Yorkers or Southerners or the British, and we know they have accents. So what makes us think our way is just neutral?
Do you think that you have an accent?
I think everybody has an accent. I didn't realize that I had one particularly until college. I went to school in New York, and my best friend was from New Jersey. And she thought it was hilarious the way I said, news. She was like, and she said something like, I don't know if I can do it, but she'd say like news. And also, we had a lot of friends named Aaron, and I thought that Aaron and Erin, they are the same to me. And she was like, that's ridiculous. It's very clear. It's like Aaron and Aaron or something like that. I was like, no.
Before you went to school in New York, like growing up, did you ever think of yourself as having an accent?
No. It's just, you think of whatever you do and what if it's the same as the people around you, it's just talking.
Right.
The official name for the accent where we live is Midland speech. If you live in a city like Indianapolis, Cincinnati, or Columbus, you probably have a Midland accent too. Funny enough, it's actually not the same as what you hear in other parts of the Midwest, like further north in Minneapolis or whatever. This is very specifically the way we talk in a narrow little belt across the country's midsection. And it's kind of weird how even those of us who talk that way don't really know about it. So on today's episode of Midwesternish, what we sound like...
What we sound like.
What we sound like.
What we sound like.
What we sound like.
And why it matters. If you wanted to hear a bunch of Midwesterners talking, people of different ages and backgrounds, where would you go?
This recording, Illinois 10, is copyright the International Dialect of English Archive.
We went to this online dialect archive called IDEA, and it's amazing. It's got audio samples of more than 1,000 people from all over the world speaking English in different dialects. The United States is broken down by region, then by state, so you can listen to people from any state speaking English, and you really get a feel for how people sound depending on where they're from. Like this woman from Arkansas.
I was born July the 10th, 1936, in Van Alstine, Texas. And then, when I was about 14 months old, my parents decided to move to Arkansas.
Or this lady from Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
Deer hunting takes place in Wisconsin in the late fall, early winter. Many hunters like if there is some snow on the ground.
A couple from Stillwater, Oklahoma.
We got married out in the middle of a cow pasture in front of a teepee wearing buckskins. It was hot. It was real hot.
And a woman from Chicago who doesn't think she has an accent.
Like when you see it on Saturday Night Live, it seems so exaggerated. But I actually think I speak like the TV announcers, you know.
It's kind of crazy how many different accents you can hear just from state to state.
Yeah, and I just want to say, like, an accent isn't exactly the same thing as a dialect. An accent is how you pronounce words, like the actual sounds you make. And dialect is all that plus common phrases people use, grammar and stuff like that. But there's one main characteristic that unites the way that we talk in the Midland speech region. To explain this, I want you to do what's called a minimal pairs test. So in front of you, there's a list of words that are similar in pairs. And I'll give you an example. Like the first one, D-O, like to do, the verb, and D-E-W, like what's on the grass early in the morning. Do and do. Got it?
Yeah. Do, do, but, bet, read, read, pin, pen, full, fool, pill, peel, caught, caught, sell, sail, don, don, no, no, hair, her, pull, pool, bowl, bull, gem, gem, poly, poly.
Okay, so you have what's called the cot-cot merger, which is a distinct characteristic of Kansas City's dialect, but also kind of the whole Midland speech region, which covers that span from Ohio through Indiana, Missouri, into Kansas. So yeah, C-A-U-G-H-T, like the past tense of to catch, and C-O-T, like an army bed, used to be pronounced with more distinct and different vowel sounds. But in the past 50 years in our region, they've been merging to become kind of the same sound. And what's interesting about that merger and others were things like B-U-L-L and B-O-W-L, bull and bull, and cot and cot are the same words, is that you probably don't even realize that you're doing that.
I can't wait to listen back to what just happened because I feel like I say bull and bull differently. Bull, bull. I feel like I say bull and bull differently. Bull and bull differently.
You don't.
Really?
No.
I mean, as a lifelong overcorrector, that's disturbing.
If it makes you feel any better, I'm even more of a vowel merger than you are. All right, do, do, but, bet, read, read, full, full, cot, cot, bowl, Bull, Jim, Jim, Polly, Polly.
Yeah, you're merged all over the place. And you're really fronting your O's too. So you're...
Wait, let me try again.
No, it's good.
Suzanne met a linguist, Christopher Streloff, a few years ago when she was looking into the Kansas City dialect.
Chris was the first one who kind of taught me about this whole Midland speech region and the fact that I have an accent.
So most of the things that we hear as regional accents are a result of somebody else's tongue being in a different position in their mouth from where you expect yours to be when they say something.
So it's all about where we put our tongues in our mouths.
If you think about New York, where you have like coffee talk, right? Well, historically, and where we would have our tongue when we say that vowel is in kind of a lower backer position. It's kind of like where if you were at the doctor and you needed to look down your throat, you'd say, ah.
Ah, ah, weird. Okay, wait. So in the Midland speech region, we say words like trap, trap, with our tongues low in our mouths, trap. And yeah, kind of forward, like close to our teeth, trap. And if I raise my tongue or pull it back when I say it, I'm going to try that. It sounds like this. Trap, trap, trap.
Yeah, and that's how they say it in Chicago, which is not part of the Midland speech region.
Oh my God, so weird.
And so Chris has studied recordings of speeches by Harry S. Truman, who was from Missouri, to figure out how long we've talked like this. Because accents and dialects aren't just about where we're from. When someone was born has a lot to do with it, too.
I can't tell you how very much I appreciate the honor which you've just conferred upon me.
So linguists can study this stuff by looking and kind of dissecting the images of the sound waves that are created by someone's speech when they play back the recordings.
We take a recording of him in 1948, we're actually getting a snapshot of what the language was in the Kansas City area over 120 years ago.
I accept the nomination.
So his nose would be up here, his throat would be down here. And when he says like the word fleece or any vowel with that E sound, his tongue would be up here in a high front position. You can feel that for yourself. If you say fleece, you feel your tongue like come almost right behind your teeth, right?
Yeah.
You got that? So then on the other end of this, this is that aw vowel I talked about, the thought vowel, and this is his lot vowel. So you can see that this aw vowel is in a completely different position for him from his ah vowel.
It's hard to tell exactly what causes our accents to change over time, but remember that ah sound from the cot-cot merger? That is a Midland thing. They don't say it that way up north.
One of the major changes that's happening in the United States is called the Northern Cities Vowel Shift, and that's when you think of a Chicago accent or a Cleveland, their vowel in a word like bat has moved up to where our vowel in a word like fleece would be. And when that vowel moved out of the way, it's dragged all their other vowels around. So our vowel in a word like cot, in the cot-cot merger, has moved forward for them to become more like cat.
In Kansas City and the rest of the Midland region, we're starting to say the vowel in a word like goat.
Goat.
In a way that sounds a lot like the vowel in strut.
Strut.
And the vowel sound in strut is starting to sound like the eh in dress.
Dress. Strut, dress. Strut, dress. I've actually noticed that one. When I say get dressed, it sometimes does sound to me like an sound coming out of my mouth, and I can't help it even when I'm trying to get it right.
Yeah, it's subtle, but it's there. Other than vowels, there are just certain phrases that Chris calls regionally marked, like the phrase, the dog wants out.
It's a kind of a Kansas City, Midland of the United States thing. Most parts of the country, it would have to be the dog wants to go out or the dog needs to be let out or something like that.
The dog wants out. The dog wants out. The dog wants to go out. Yeah, I guess that's true.
You know, the point is, it's something that's regionally specific, but nobody comments on it anywhere. And so we don't realize that we're doing this very locally specific thing.
It's almost like since nobody makes fun of our accent, we don't even notice that we have one. That brings us to Paul Meyer. He's a voice coach and he helps people lose their accents. But he doesn't get a lot of clients from around here.
I don't think I've ever gotten a call from someone from Iowa, Nebraska, Missouri, Kansas. Help me lose my accent. You know, just nobody calls for that.
In fact, a lot of the time, what people want is that standard Midwestern accent. It became the norm a long time ago when guys from Chicago wrote the manual for broadcasters, the NBC pronunciation guide. Also, people like Johnny Carson and Walter Cronkite, they were all Midwesterners and they talked the same way. At least they did on the air, and all of that turned the Midwestern accent into what I guess some people now consider America's accent. Anyway, Suzanne went to talk with Paul to find out more about the pressure people feel to sound like us.
Paul's background is actually in theater. He started out training actors to do accents for certain roles, but Paul isn't just working with thespians.
About 50% of my business is working with what I call real people as opposed to actors.
What they want is known as accent reduction.
I get a lot of people from the South who says, I know I talk wrong, I want you to help me fix it. Which, of course, is a terrible indictment of our value system that they're speaking incorrectly, when, of course, they're not speaking incorrectly at all. They're just speaking a different dialect.
Paul has been doing this coaching for more than 40 years, and he says that for as long as he's been in the business, people have been judged for their dialects.
It's sad that we are not more accepting of diversity in dialects. We speak a great deal today about diversity and acceptance of diversity, but yet it's still okay to mock people with a Southern accent, for example. It's still okay for some reason. And people's career trajectories are impeded by their accent. So people know this, and they come to a coach like me. Carmel or caramel? How do you pronounce it, Suzanne?
Carmel.
Carmel. You're with the majority, 64%.
So Suzanne talked to Paul, and he ended up giving her a quiz. Language people really seem to love these quizzes. He wanted to test out how Missouri her speech patterns are. But hold on a minute, because as long as we're going there, Suzanne and I are friends, and I've noticed a few things. Like, she says anyways with an S.
Anyways?
Yeah, you say anyways.
How do you say it?
Anyway.
Anyways. Anyway. Why would you say, what? Wait, just a second. Anyways versus anyway. Anyways with an S is considered slang and is part of non-standard colloquial or informal English. Furthermore, since anyway is an adverb and it is impossible for adverbs to be plural, I never thought about that. In newspaper or in any example of formal writing, you will almost never see the word anyways used.
Okay, well, so anyway.
Anyways.
Anyway, for the most part, she sounds normal to me. Let's see what Paul thinks. He lives in Kansas, which is right next door to Missouri, but he's British.
Do you say crick or creek, the small body of running water?
Creek.
92% of Missourians report creek as their preferred pronunciation. Suzanne, do you say Florida, 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 or Florida? One, A, B, C, or D?
I'm just going to say it how I say it. I'm going to Florida.
Again?
Florida.
You're in line with the majority of Missourians, 84.79%, according to the Harvard survey. There's the Mary, 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 Mary.
Yeah, Mary, Mary, Mary. Okay, so this Mary, Mary, Mary business gets back to the main defining characteristic of Midland speech. We merge our vowels. I am trying to read three different words that we say the exact same way around here. M-E-R-R-Y, as in Merry Christmas. M-A-R-R-Y, as in Will you be my wife? Will you marry me? And then the name, Mary. Mary, Mary, Mary. And obviously, Paul has to work with people on cultivating that blurring of our vowel sounds if they want to sound Midwestern. But he also has to teach them something else.
You can take any sentence, and in English, we will have certain words that we're going to stress. We'll have certain words that we're going to stress. We're going to have certain words that we're going to stress, as opposed to we're going to have certain words that we're going to stress. And immediately it sounds foreign because I'm stressing by a different set of rules. Let me give you a quick example. So you might say, in English, British and American English, we would say, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. There's only two stressed words for us. I can't believe I ate the whole thing. Simply pointing out that trick that we have whole word strings that we just kind of slur. I can't believe I ate the I can't believe I ate the, and it's very casual, but to get them to tune into that music, that rhythm, on a habitual basis is the hard thing.
So Paul Meyer, whose job is to help people mimic different accents so they can blend in, he lives in Kansas, but he hasn't really picked up a Kansas accent.
You can still hear the British accent in my speech, of course. The Brits think I'm American, the Americans think I'm British, so I'm doomed to be a man without a home.
Paul says there are two kinds of people when it comes to this question of fitting in.
Those who adapt and are a little bit chameleon-like and don't want to be kept asked, where are you from? Where are you from? And others, I've got several good friends who, no matter who they're speaking to, they are they themselves. They never change. And I kind of admire that. I guess I was just one of the ones who just wanted to blend in.
Suzanne, have you ever been made fun of for the way you talk?
No, not really. You?
Oh, if anything, I guess I get made fun of for over-enunciating, like with words like comfortable is a big one, or restaurant. I pronounce all of the syllables, which is not Midwestern at all. It's just me. It's like the Gina dialect or something.
Yeah, I've actually noticed that you do that. But this Gina dialect is not as ridiculous as you might think. So remember linguist Christopher Streliff? I asked him how many dialects there are, and this is what he had to say.
I think there's, 300-some-odd million Americans right now, so 300-some-odd million dialects, and that seems like a really lame answer. But, the truth is dialect really exists at the individual level.
But the thing about this whole thing is it really goes beyond individuals, time, and geographic regions. Chris says it also has a lot to do with perception.
There's an idea of the Midwest, and when people talk about Midwest as an accent-free area, they make their perception of facts fit that idea rather than shaping their ideas to fit the actual facts on the ground. The idea of a Midwest accent says a lot more about the way that people want to think about the Midwest as a place being kind of uninteresting and bland and neutral rather than something that's actually really going on in the world.
So we have this reputation for being this place without an accent, which is clearly not true. Do you think that says something more about what people think about this region, or says something more about specifically about who we are?
What is considered the norm is what people expect to find in the Midwest. And that's maybe the most that has been the most visible part of Midwestern culture. I don't know, I guess everything else is seen as some kind of flavor, whereas we're seen as kind of like the toast that the flavor get, you know what I'm saying?
Blander.
But that's also partly about what you're ignoring when you look at the Midwest.
Yeah, Chris talked about that too.
We also, when we talk about a Midwest accent, it sort of encodes that we're thinking along racially white terms. There are many dialects of African American Englishes throughout the areas that are Midwest. There are many dialects of Latino English, and many other ethnically marked dialects that are really part of the language fabric of the Midwest that don't get included in a term like the Midwest accent.
There are a lot of accents in the Midwest, not just the quote-unquote Midwestern accent, but accents from all over the world. Suzanne knows what it's like to be the one with the accent, the kind of accent that marks you as an outsider. She has relatives in Ecuador and Costa Rica, and her mom is a Spanish speaker, but Suzanne mostly learned Spanish in school. And she remembers when she finally knew the language well enough to hang out with her cousin and his friends.
And at some point, one of his friends is like, "Why do you talk so funny? Like, ¿por qué hablas tan extraño?" I was like, "Oh, I mean...
Spanish is not my first language. He just thought I talked funny, you know? He didn't know. He didn't realize that I was an American just trying to learn Spanish during her semester abroad. And I thought, like, man, that's cool. If I can go as, like, passing, you know, like, as just, like, some Tica Costa Rican that talks funny, like, that is, I'll take that. Because, like, for me, just feeling comfortable and knowing what people were saying was such an accomplishment to me that I just don't care about my accent sounding strange. I mean, when I hear people speak English as a second language and I hear them speak and they have a really thick accent, like, I think it doesn't bother me. I find it really beautiful and cool. And I know sometimes people can, who are in that situation, really are self-conscious about their accent. I'm like, no, that's great. Like, because I understand how hard it is to learn a language. It's really hard.
I think it is actually really important for us to know that we have accents just like everyone else on the planet, that we're not more normal than anyone else or more American. I mean, that we're not less than anyone else either. I seriously want every Midwesterner listening to this right now to get up, go look in the mirror and say, I am someone and I live somewhere and I sound like something.
Are you serious?
Oh, Susanna, we should really do an episode about Midwestern modesty sometime.
Yeah, okay. We can start working on it.
I think that's a wrap. Midwesternish is a podcast from KCUR Studios. It's made by me and Suzanne Hogan.
Whose Line Is It Anyways? Remember that show?
No, wasn't that Whose Line Is It Anyway?
What? Oh. Yeah, it's Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Our editor is Sylvia Maria Gross. And just a few more things. If you had fun listening to Midwesternish today, we have a lot more episodes ready now for you to listen to. Just subscribe to Midwesternish wherever you get your podcasts. We're trying to put our finger on all those weird little Midwestern quirks that we all kind of know about but don't always recognize as being special. If you have a uniquely Midwesternish observation and a story that goes with it, you should pitch it to us. Just leave a voicemail in less than a minute with your story and what you think is Midwesternish about it. Here's the number. Are you ready? 816-235-2797. That's 816-235-2797. Your story might end up in season 3. P.S. There's a big Midwesternish storytelling event, and you are invited. It's all about road trips. Monday, April 23rd at the Record Bar. Admission's free, just RSVP so we know you're coming. Go to kcur.org/live. And that's it. I'm Gina Kaufman. I love you, Midwest. Thank you.